Hi, everyone. Welcome to Oscar Wild, a podcast about film, always counting down to this year's Oscars. I'm Nick Ruhrkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And we finally made it to, I would say, the most exciting period on Oscar Wild that we do every year. So we've gotten our Oscar nominations. I know we didn't do a reaction episode, but we can talk about a little bit of that as we go through some of the categories. So during this series, we'll go through each category, each Oscar nominee, and talk about some of the characteristics of the work in that film or the people nominated. This is a series we do leading up to the Oscars. So today we'll be talking about the categories for makeup and hairstyling, costume design, and production design. I can't wait to talk about these nominees, some of my favorite surprises that we had Oscar nomination morning, and going through them really helps deepen our appreciation of why these are nominees.
Yeah, I think that's my favorite part of the Contender series, especially when we're doing below the line nominees. So talking about all of the craft categories, it really always gives me a deeper appreciation for the work that these artisans contribute to these projects. And in this case, this year, we had some surprise nominees pop up in different categories and some really inspired choices, movies that I don't think I would have watched, honestly, or maybe wouldn't have been on my radar as much had the films not received Oscar nominations. So I think that's also always something that happens every year, is that the Oscars can really, I think, shine a light on films that maybe wouldn't have been seen otherwise.
I totally agree. So the way this will work today and throughout the series, I would also recommend going back and listening to our shortlist episode and predictions episode, where we talk about more of the rules and how these nominees get picked. But for each category, we'll mention all the nominees and then do some wrap-up questions, including our write-in votes and who we think should win. Who we think will win will come when we do our final Oscar predictions right before the ceremony. So just to get right into it, we'll start with makeup and hairstyling. This was a category with a shortlist and was narrowed down to its five nominees after a bake-off, where each nominee got to share and highlight some of its best features, characteristics, work in that film, followed by a question and answer period. So our nominees here, we have Frankenstein, Kokuo, Sinners, The Smashing Machine, and The Ugly Stepsister. So to start off, what did you think of this category as a whole?
I think this is actually where we get some of the most inspired, exciting nominees. The Ugly Stepsister being here, I think we should always have a gruesome, gory horror feature here if we can. And we'll talk about what my experience was like watching that film as a squeamish moviegoer. And we also, you know, got to see Kokuo here. I think that that was on a few people's predictions list, but definitely one that was, I think, a bit unexpected too, as to whether or not it could make it through. And then we also have, you know, two Best Picture nominees here in Frankenstein and Sinners, both with really creative prosthetic work that's been discussed all season. And The Smashing Machine, I am excited to talk about that because the makeup is done by Kazuhiro, who is a legend, I think, in the field. But you hadn't seen this film yet, so I want to spend a little bit of time on what you thought of it. Not just the makeup, but the film too. But overall, I think this is a good category.
Yeah, I agree. This was my favorite category announcement of the morning, I think, because of what you said, the collection of nominees that were either unexpected or this is their sole nomination. And we've talked about that before with Bennett and just having some inspiration to what they pick and not just going along with the same number of films that we see in different categories. Not saying those aren't deserving, but if you look at trends over the years too, you see that the number of feature films nominated decreases, and we only have 35 feature films that are nominated for an Oscar this year. But I think in looking into these films, it really made me appreciate why they're mentioned here. And also, like you said, I don't know if I would have seen Kokuo had this not shown up or had I not seen that name on the shortlist. It was a Toronto, and I was like, do I want to sit through a 3-hour film where I could see multiple other films or depending on the availability and schedule? So I'm actually very happy I ended up seeing this and that it had an IMAX release. It is now the number one selling live action Japanese film in Japan, which is an incredible feat. And I'm glad we get to talk about that very soon. We'll start with Frankenstein. So the nominees here are Mike Hill, Jordan Samuel, and Cleona Fury. These are all first-time nominations. So what is your favorite use of hairstyling or makeup that we see in the film?
Well, I think when we think about the work in Frankenstein, you have to go to the intense prosthetics and creature design for Jacob Elordi here as the creature. And there are a number of interviews with this team discussing the prosthetics. But what I really like about the work is that you can still feel Elordi's performance and you really get to, I think, understand his choices as an actor. He's not completely buried in these prosthetics, despite them being pretty extreme. And I learned through an interview with Jazz Tankay at Variety that the only parts of this look that are actually Jacob are the tip of the nose, the upper lip, and his chin. The rest, all prosthetics. And this team also talked about how they wanted to make him look a bit older and more mature because he was only 26 at the time of filming. So that was a challenge for them. And through that, they built this new sculpted brow that he wore. And I, again, you know, we joked about this as we talked about the film throughout the year, but you really can see that he is still beautiful under all of those prosthetics. And I think that's such a core component of this character and why his performance has resonated with so many people.
I also really liked reading about that and seeing that Netflix has some featurettes that also feature the makeup and hair style designers on the film and how they created those prosthetic pieces that go on him. Going back to our Best of 2025 episode, you mentioned Jacob Elordi as a smash of the year, one of the hottest. And I will say, in watching this time-lapse video of them applying them to him, you can really see him through the prosthetics, which I didn't initially when those first stills came out, but I was like, yes, he's gorgeous. I also didn't realize that they were applying them right to his body. Like, it wasn't a suit. It wasn't this bigger piece. It was single patches of what appeared to be like different pieces of skin that they were putting together. And there were 42 different prosthetic pieces. It took up to 11 hours to do this on him. And in the video, you even see like the yellowed fingernails that they are either applying or painting. So it's just like the work is so specific. It's incredible to see happen. And then I think it ends up making you look at it differently when you see the movie. I would also just want to shout out Mia's wig that mm-hmm. she wears because it's like 4 feet long. Like, the hair is incredible. And it took 8 weeks to make this wig out of real hair. And how they do that with extensions or plugs or whatever the words are. And it took an hour to put it on Mia Goth's head. So, I mean, these procedures are not easy. They are time intensive. They're done by hand. And I think it really shows in the product, especially this Guillermo del Toro vision that is so romantic. And like we'll also mention in costume design for this, just feels like you're in the 1850s when this movie is set.
Mm-hmm. And you talking about Mia Goth, that was something I noticed right away when I watched the movie, is that she's actually playing two characters in this, right? She's playing Lady Elizabeth and she's also playing Claire, who is Victor's mother. And even that transformation of changing up her face just slightly with the makeup, I thought was a really cool addition. Mm-hmm. But yeah, very well-deserved nomination. Next, let's get into one of those exciting nominations that we talked about, which is Kokuho. So our team here, we have Kyoko Toyokawa, Naomi Hibino, and Tadashi Nishimatsu. They are all first-time nominees, and this is also the first makeup team for a Japanese-produced film nominated at the Oscars. I just watched this film yesterday for the first time, and I was just so impressed, I think, by the volume of hair and makeup here that we have. There's so much of it, and there's also a great interview with the director of this film, Lee Sang-il, with Bong Joon-ho, and they talk about the tradition of kabuki and how younger audiences might respond to that, so I definitely recommend checking that out. But what was your favorite use of hair and makeup in the film?
I didn't know much going into this movie. I didn't know that it was going to be a decades-long adventure between these two men that work in the kabuki theater, and I didn't really even know what kabuki was. So I learned so much just watching this movie, and I've had people mention to me that I should see Farewell My Concubine, which is an Oscar nominee from the past. It won the Palme d'Or. It won the Silver Frog. So it's an established film that is similar, talking about a similar story. But I was so amazed by the de-aging and the aging makeup. Apart from the kabuki makeup, the wisteria maiden style makeup that the Onagata wear, what you would probably imagine of the white powdered face, the eyeliner, and the lipstick, which is on the movie's poster. So you see a little bit of that. But I think the aging really blew me away because it makes these people believably, which we've seen so much in movies over time, where you can tell immediately. And I don't know if that's because we've been so sensitized to it or we're just more aware of it over time, but you see how specific and good they are of making these men look younger, even like teenagers, and then as they age and get older, have believable lines on their face. And also with Ken Watanabe, who is in the film, I would say the film's biggest star that we would know, but it's beautiful work. And then when you're in the kabuki theater, when you're seeing them perform, I think you're just so amazed by watching them act and makes you really want to be in Japan and watch something like this in person because it feels like it's very authentic to their culture.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I thought the de-aging was great because that was something that I didn't know about going into the film. I think I was just really expecting the kabuki makeup because that had mostly been what was discussed around this film potentially getting a nomination. But I agree with you. I thought it was really well done. For me, though, it really was just how striking that kabuki makeup was. That bright white makeup, but also those like crimson red lips and how that looked really against the costumes, too. The makeup and also those wigs, I think, really complemented the bright reds and the floral designs of the costume, those rich golds that we see throughout the movie, too. And I agree with you. It really, I think, transported me there. Also, definitely recommend Farewell My Concubine. I saw that at Film Forum a few years ago. They did a 4K restoration. Yeah. And similarly, I think really just stunning hair and makeup looks in that as well.
Okay, next up is Sinners. Our nominees, we have Ken Diaz. This is his third nomination. Michael Fontaine, this is his second nomination. And Shunika Terry, this is her first nomination. So what do you like about the makeup and hairstyling in Sinners?
Well, we talked about a little bit how much I love makeup in horror films, and the work in Sinners is no exception. One of the things I learned from the featurette was that really every single character has some sort of makeup design or addition or look because they are affected by the vampires and the horrors of the film. And Coogler actually pulled in Mike Fontaine onto this project because of his work on Green Room. Coogler said that he hadn't felt that effect from makeup since watching The Thing, so he had to pull him in here. I think that's such a great call out. And Fontaine and team talked about actually looking at animal attacks for the bite wounds. They wanted to really see the wreckage from how an animal might attack its prey. When really designing these scratches and these bites, they went to the reality that animals experience rather than to other movie references. So if you watch how he puts together these prosthetics, he molds them and designs them, and then he sent them off to New York, and they would create these little silicone molds that they would attach to their faces. And everything was custom made for each character. And it's so funny, too, because they all also talked about fake blood and how there were so many different kinds of fake blood, and how as actors, it just gets really sticky and gross and difficult to deal with, but also how much fun they all had working on this. So I think it's a great showcase, though. There really are, again, just so many gross, cool pieces in this film.
Yeah, I think here's another good instance of volume. I loved that fact about Green Room because I'm also a big fan of that movie, and it gets very bloody very quickly. But I think with Sinners, as I was watching probably a similar featurette, I got more and more grossed out by it. And I'm not usually grossed out by things. I would say I don't think I was during the film, but seeing them apply it and how it looks so real without the veneer of, you know, just those final effects that they put on the frame that you see in a theater. It looks real just on the person, and they didn't need effects to heighten that. And I think that's what really speaks to the team's work here and Coogler's vision in making this work. I would say my favorite instance or strongest feeling of being grossed out was with Cornbread.
Yeah.
And so after his face is shot, and I love how they talk about, you know, how do we mask his chin because his face is blown off? And they add layers, which also allows them to take away layers of fascia and blood and how it just drips when the characters move. I would say the other really cool thing is with Jack O'Connell's character, Remick. They saw him as, in the beginning, he looks human, and that's kind of his final form of masking himself. And by the end of the film, he looks like this demon, this vampire that is fully turned, but that's who he normally is. So the way they worked through that of kind of unraveling, taking layers away to reveal his true persona, I think is a really cool backstory to looking at a character and allowing an actor to really come into who this person is. And the effects, I think, just add on to that realism that they make in a movie like this.
I think so, too. And I really also think about like the first scene of the movie, right? Where before we flash back, seeing Sammy like that, it is really terrifying, right? Because you don't know what's happened to him. You don't know what he's about to do. It just immediately establishes this movie as having very high stakes, especially for that character. And I also love his wound on his face, those scratches, how deep they are. And the team talked about that too, of just how they had to get that look of just the layers of skin peeling back from that wound. Ugh. It's really, really good. Next, we have The Smashing Machine. So our nominees here, we have Kazuhiro. He has 2 wins for Darkest Hour and Bombshell and 4 other nominations. And then we also have Glenn P. Griffin and Bjorn Rabine. They're both first-time nominees. So what was your favorite use of hair and makeup in the film? And what did you think of The Smashing Machine?
Yes, this was one of my final watches, I will say. There was a film holding strong as my least favorite nominee, and this overtook it. I was not a fan of this movie. I think the makeup work in it is understood why it's here. Like you talking about during predictions of Kazuhiro being a master, and that really does show in featurettes and interviews of him just being so precise. I love to see his mind kind of at work and thinking about how different actors sweat different chemicals, and that really informing after a few days of filming what glue they use, how much, or what kind of products or prosthetics go in which areas of the face based on where they sweat too. That was kind of a big thing that he talked about. So that's just not anything I'm thinking of. It's like, I would be thinking, you know, how do we make this person look as much like the character that we're trying to emulate? And that was a different conversation between the team and Benny Safdie of what percentage of Mark Kerr they wanted Dwayne Johnson to look like or to see behind his actual face. So I think that conversation made the work more impressive, especially when they also talk about having to worry about those getting either ruined or disfigured because of everything else that really Dwayne Johnson, I would say, is the biggest instance in this case doing. But what did you think of the work in this film?
I think this is a great example, though, of where he feels like a real person. His name is Mark Kerr, you know, and not just an actor swallowed by these prosthetics. You can really, I think, still get a sense of Dwayne Johnson and his performance here. And I learned through this that he spent 4 hours in the makeup chair every day and that there were 22 different prosthetic pieces that he wore. So I think it is fairly subtle work from one of these, you know, kinds of movies where an actor is doing a big transformation. But these 22 prosthetics included eyes, his face, forehead, scars, cauliflower ears, and of course, there was a wig that he wore. So it really is, I think, more of a transformation than from what you're just seeing in the film, or even I remember when the stills were released. It's not extremely showy work. I think that the work they're doing on Blunt is also very funny here because you get a sense of who this woman is. But yeah, I think that the work on Johnson is very good. I am just, like you, not a huge fan of this movie or the performance underneath those prosthetics.
Yeah, I think with Emily Blunt, a good way to say it would be like giving her a more youthful face. And the biggest maybe issue I had with him were the wigs. And I think, you know, part of that is the steroid use maybe, or the effect of that and how it affects the hair maybe. I mean, that's what I was thinking of in a more medical sense. But then when he shaves his head, I was a little taken aback. Okay, let's move on to our final nominee. We have the Ugly Stepsister. The nominees for the film include Thomas Foldberg and Anne Catherine Sauerberg. They're both first-time nominees. What did you think of this movie and the makeup and hair?
I don't know if I've ever shared this with listeners before or on this podcast, but I have an intense phobia of worms. And because of that, this movie was a very challenging watch. If you are like me and worms are just not your thing, if a tapeworm terrified you when you also learned about it for the first time in health class, this might not be your journey, and that's okay. You might have to look away just like I did. Like, it is a brutal watch, but I do think that the themes are executed very well. I think that, yes, it is a little bit on the nose and blunt, but I think a lot of body horror features are. Like, if you think of The Substance last year, that I think had similar challenges that I had to overcome in watching it. But here, I think in playing with Cinderella as a fairy tale, they do a really good job. And also how the film looks at beauty standards. Again, I had a really hard time watching it just because I'm squeamish around tapeworms, which we can talk about and how they're used in this movie. But I did like it. Like, when I think back on the movie, I do think it's very effective and well made. I'm just issuing a warning for anyone else who might be traumatized by these things. I'll let you discuss the tapeworms. But my favorite uses, I think, of hair and makeup really there is a scene where, so she goes to this like esthetician, plastic surgeon to get all of these treatments. Elvira, our main character, who is, of course, one of the stepsisters. And this film, I think, is so good at making you feel empathy and really feel for her. And one of the treatments that she undergoes is having these eyelashes stitched into her lash line. So she has these intense, dramatic bottom lashes. It is so gross when you're watching the scene. And it really is just like very visceral. But I love these lashes. And the makeup team was inspired by Shelley Duvall, I learned, in creating this lash look. And also these like 60s mod glamour girls and models who had those very intense eyelashes that they would separate with a lot of mascara. So I love the look there. And then another gross one for me. So if you're familiar with the original Cinderella fairy tale, you will know this is coming. This is obviously not in the Disney version, but in that, the stepsisters cut off their toes so that they can fit into Cinderella's slipper. And we see that here. And there is a shot of these toes hanging on for dear life after she has taken this cleaver to them. That was cool. I loved that. How those looked, just the blood and them just bent over hanging there, and she still has to chop them off all the way. Oh, it's so gnarly. But yeah, what did you think of the film, and what was your favorite use of hair and makeup?
I was a big fan of this movie. I'm glad it made the shortlist and then got nominated. I think what the story is doing with the empathy you're describing for the characters and how that changes, I think was really interesting and unexpected. And then the effects that they use to get us to some of those points, those emotional climaxes, or really just how to set up the story. Like early in the film, we see Elvira get bullied and really be this other, and she's approached with this tapeworm pill and she swallows it. I love there's the shot of her holding it between her teeth. And then really you see her transformation, yes, rising in popularity and success, but then at the same time, her hair is thinning, her teeth chip. You see the degradation of her body. So I think the team, in allowing us to see those minor changes, apart from like the big finale, like you're talking about, the arterial blood, like just throbbing out of her cut off toes, or at the very end when that tapeworm is pulled out of her throat, and it's just like dozens of worms coming out of her body. If you haven't seen it, you can maybe imagine what you're seeing, but
no, you can't.
It's nothing like I've ever seen before. It really isn't. And those kinds of feelings of just wowing me after the amount of movies that we watched, especially, those are the things that really excite me. And it immediately made me think of The Substance and just the amount of effects and blood and everything they did on that set. In a similar way here, I love the detail work and really just how gruesome it feels and sickens you as you watch it.
So I knew that everything was about to go down when she gets the tapeworm egg. Like the fact that it's an egg, too, I was like, girl, please do not eat this. Like, just don't swallow this. It's not going to end well for you. But I also, like, it makes you think of diet pill culture and the drugs that people are taking to lose weight. I mean, I'm sure that there are plenty of people who would do this.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, the thing is, too, is like she gets an antidote, right? Like she definitely should have taken that early on, but she pushes it too far. And when they're at the ball and she starts throwing up the eggs, I truly...
Yeah. That like dark bile. Oh, it's so cool.
And when I said I was having a rough time with it and I texted you that and you're like, oh, it's about to get worse. I'm like, how is it going to get worse? And it did.
Oh, it's a great character transformation. Again, I think an inclusion on this list that is exciting for both of us, for better or worse. But I think in wrapping up the category, what would your write-in vote be?
My write-in vote would be for One Battle After Another. I think just because of the transformation to the Lockjaw character. I will never forget the first time when I saw this movie, and you see him from behind at first when he's in that final meeting with the Christmas Adventurers, and you already have this thought of how did he survive being shot in the face as he was driving, but he's there, and then you get that look at him, and we see the eye and all the prosthetic work to one side of his face. It really is shocking, and he just is such a pitiful character, I think, especially at the end. And this prosthetic work only really elevates that. So I would say One Battle After Another. What would your write-in vote be?
I think just to veer away from maybe some other easier snubs that were on the shortlist, I would say Bring Her Back. Maybe a movie I had difficulty with, but I think in the same horror sense of some other picks like The Ugly Stepsister or Weapons, which I think we largely expected to see here because of its effect or just being a reminder of the effect of that film. But I think the effects here are similar. They're disturbing, they're gory, but all of the things that they do to Oliver, including the hair, really taking away hair, the blood. I don't even want to talk about the teeth scene where they're eating the wood off this table. And the minute they zoomed in on the teeth, I said, nope. And I put my hand up. I could not watch it. You hear the teeth break and they have these cool contacts. The way they make them look so scary and demon-like is really remarkable, especially for a child. So I think some other works like that, I hope voters continue to think up unique films like this in the future.
And who do you think should win?
I think I'm torn here between Sinners and The Ugly Stepsister. I think I would favor Sinners just with the amount of work that they had to do on dozens of actors, including background actors, even though I love how different the practical effects were in The Ugly Stepsister. So I don't think with either of those options you could go wrong. What do you think should win?
I'm going with The Ugly Stepsister. This movie horrified me in so many ways, and I think you have so many disgusting, creative, and original looks where they just go all out. Like, they do not shy away from this horrific imagery that at times made me feel like I needed to shower after watching this. Like, I felt so disgusted. And I think it's just, again, it's really creative work. It's very vivid. I will not get some of these images out of my mind, for better or for worse. So I'm going to go with The Ugly Stepsister. Let's move on to our next category. We have costume design. So our guild here, we have the Costume Designers Guild, so they will announce their winners on February 16th. Our nominees, we have Avatar Fire and Ash, Frankenstein, Hamnet, Marty Supreme, and Sinners. What do you think of this group overall?
I think this is a great variety of work that we see. You know, with the guild, there are different categories. So we have a mix of period and sci-fi or fantasy. I think that sci-fi movie being Avatar Fire and Ash is something nobody expected to get in. So I think just the announcement or looking into how costumes in animated films added digitally to films, it was just a very interesting process to learn about. But I think when you think of each title specifically, you're able to bring to mind something from the film that really wowed you. And I think that's why we're seeing these movies here, is that each film has some signature looks that are deeply embedded in the film. And why I think some of the other names we really expected to be here because of just that work in the film. what do you think of this as a collection?
Yeah, I agree. I think that the shocker of the morning, really of any category, was Avatar: Fire and Ash getting a costume design nomination. And I will say, doing the research through this series actually made me appreciate this nomination a lot more than initially when I just thought, what is happening here? I did not predict this. No one did. But I think we have a good variety here. I will note that these are all period. And I think that that's something we see. I like when we have a little bit of variety and we get some contemporary costumes, but it's really rare, I think, that that happens. So I think this is a mostly expected list, but I think there's also some really great work here that I'm excited to dig into. So let's start with Avatar: Fire and Ash. Our costume designer here is Deborah L. Scott. She has one win for Titanic, and this is her second nomination overall. What did you like learning about her costume design, and what was your favorite costume from the film?
So I think the process that Deborah and her team construct all of the costumes in real life, they weave fabrics together. And the big thing, I didn't even really think about this with the first two films, but how each tribe is signified by different characteristics and different cloths, different textures, and how they fabricate those, bring them together. So they construct all of those costumes, and then they have the FX teams come in, scan the pieces, and then add them to the digital or 3D constructed worlds. And in that, they have to really recreate those costumes and make sure they fit on the characters right, the colors are correct, that they move in the way that the bodies do digitally. So she talks about having to do this process twice. So the fact that it takes weeks, months to do this, multiplying that by two, has to be mind-numbing to a degree, but also fun in the way they construct and differentiate everybody. And there are so many characters, but I think my favorite quality is that they added seashells, they added braids and feathers. And I think the one thing in Fire and Ash that is really significant is Varang's headdress. You know, she is the leader. That what Deborah says in the featurette is that she's like this peacock strutting. So she is the person. And I think that's what you come away from the movie thinking about most likely is her character, because so much of the film, I would say, is a repetition of The Way of Water. What is your favorite inclusion from the film, or what did you like from Avatar: Fire and Ash?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is what you've said, because I had no idea really what her process was of having to create these physical costumes and then work so closely with the VFX team and with the virtual artists to have them understand the construction. So much thought and work went into this. And I agree with you. I think she is, for me, like the saving grace of this movie. She's so fun to watch. I think in part also because of Una Chaplin's performance. But one of the things that I loved that Scott talks about is that these characters, they're making their clothing from what's in their environment. So there's a rustic, minimalist quality to it. But with her, like you said, they wanted to give her a headdress and to have something feel a little bit more extreme for this character who, like you said, is like a peacock strutting. And as she was talking to James Cameron, she said, she needs a battle headdress. We've got to move away from what she wears every day and give her something even more spectacular. And this costume actually took her 4 months to make. And if you look at her too, like all of these feathers and the reds and the oranges and the browns, these are all colors of fire and ash. So it's a good contrast too, I think, to what we saw in the last film where, yes, we are getting a lot of repetition, I think, in this story when you think about Way of Water to Fire and Ash. But this character is what we have that is brand new, and I think that does make this a bit more exciting. So I wanted the movie to really just be focused on her because she's so fabulous and fun to watch.
Our next nominee is Frankenstein and the costume designer Kate Hawley. This is her first nomination. You briefly mentioned the red dress from the beginning. You clocked that it was Mia, but I will say I didn't know it was Mia until well after I watched, and I recently rewatched, and I'm like, okay, yes, now I see it. But what other costume maybe, or what about that costume did you like from Frankenstein?
Yeah, so what's funny is that this was my favorite costume from the film. It's Mia Goth's look as Victor's mother, Claire. And it's when she has that gorgeous, long, red, sheer veil that drapes over her face and then gets swept up in the wind really behind her. And it creates this stunning silhouette. But this was one of the first images I saw of Frankenstein before I even saw the movie. And I thought, oh my God, I need to know what's going on with these costumes. I think this is just great work. And I think you have a lot of art and art history references throughout, but my favorites really are with how Hawley used the color red on this character, Claire. And she's only in a bit of the movie. She's not in it for very long, but you see traces of her through the color red on other characters throughout the film. And in that first dress that you mentioned, I think that is really that first instance. But one of the things that Hawley talked about in an interview with Vogue was that we have Elizabeth, the later Mia Goth character. She has that red too that then echoes Claire from the beginning. So she's connected really to these women later on in the film. And she has this great quote where she says, she's quite stylized as a character. She's the mother. She's the Madonna. My job as a costume designer is to serve my director and the text. In this case, I had two texts, the script and the novel. And with both, it was emotional. So she's really thinking about the novel and religious symbolism in how you look at his mother, Claire, and then later at Elizabeth. And then by having Mia Goth play both characters, they almost feel like doppelgangers or twin versions of a character, which I think is really cool. And I love how she shows that through the costumes, too. What about you? What was your favorite?
It's hard to have a favorite in this movie because I think the minute the movie started, I said, it's winning the Oscar for a costume design. There's so much of it, yes, but the work on it, the details are incredibly gorgeous. And there are just so many different costumes, especially worn by Mia Goth, that are magnificent. I would say her wedding dress, the green dress she wears, also the blue one at one point with those feathers as the cap that she has. There was an interview on Harper's Bazaar, and I loved what Kate said, which is that Guillermo and his vision, it was all part of rebelling against the sea of black. So everything in this movie has vivid colors. And, you know, the red that you're talking about, all of the jewelry that they have from Tiffany's, like everything contrasts so beautifully with each other and has just beautiful symbolism underneath all of it. With that, there are changes that we see that we kind of talked about with the makeup of how characters change or how things evolve in the costumes throughout the film.
Next up, we have Hamnet. Our costume designer is Malgosia Terzanska. This is her first nomination. What did you think of the costumes in Hamnet, and did you have a favorite?
I think my favorite is Agnes's red dress. The one that we see at the end is just so iconic in terms of her character and one that does change throughout the film. So we see her in the beginning, and I love that Malgosia says, you know, it's a red dress. It looks like a berry, like a living mussel that later changes into a color like a darker scab. And there are a lot of animalistic characteristics in the costumes, which I really love to hear. So definitely recommend looking at all of the featurettes with Malgosia. What was your favorite costume from the film?
I love the costume design here, I think especially because it references what our expectations are of costume design and fashion from the time, yet also incorporates little twists and touches that are really character specific. I also really liked what they put Will in because it's such a great contrast to that deep, dark blood red that you see Anya's in. He's wearing these like blues and grays and it's very pleasing, I will say. And they used iron gall ink to dye his clothes. And this was a really popular ink that Shakespeare would have used to write. So it's just these little touches. And then if you look at his vest, there are these little slashes in it. There are these little cuts in the back of it. And this would have been a really common technique that you would have seen back then. But Terzanska said that she imagined those scratches coming from his abusive father. You see him wearing a toothpick around his neck. He's a glover, but he's also picking at and needling his son throughout the movie until he finally pushes back against him. So she wanted it to look like he had these little scratches in his vest and for that to be a reference to his relationship with his father and how different his relationship with his children was.
Next, we have Marty Supreme. The costume designer is Miyako Bellizzi, and this is her first nomination. What costumes did you like from the film?
I love the costume design here. I love the trousers and everything really from this period. And you just have so many different costumes, really, as you're going to all of these locations too. You're in London, you're on the Lower East Side, the Upper East Side of New York. But I have to say, I loved everything that Gwyneth Paltrow was wearing in this movie, no surprise. And one of the things that Josh Safdie said was that Miyako Bellizzi, our costume designer, she wanted the Lower East Side to look like it was in the past and for the Upper East Side to look like it was going into the future. So on the Lower East Side, they would have, you know, not been able to afford these new trends that we're seeing Paltrow wearing as Kay, this starlet on the Upper East Side who clearly has a lot of money. So she was wearing things that would have been straight off the runway. And they looked at Balenciaga and Dior, two really popular fashion houses at the time. And there are two looks that she's wearing that I really love. One is her like silky satin robe. It's like this gold champagne color that she's wearing in the hotel. But then also that first outfit we see Kay in when she's walking into the Ritz in London. That is just straight out of Dior in the 50s. It's so evocative of something Grace Kelly would have worn. I think it just like calls to mind a classic Hollywood star. But what did you like about the costumes? And did you have a favorite costume from Marty Supreme?
I loved hearing about Kay and how Miyako really wanted to transition from black and white, her wardrobe in the beginning, to this emotionally awoken design. At the end of the film, like when she's in that red evening coat, she really is the opposite of what Marty is in that moment. So I love that, you know, you kind of see this transformation through her character. Again, there's a large amount. They had over 5,000 costumes. And I think another one that comes to mind are Marty's zoot suits. So they're also period correct. They look like what people wore back in the 40s and 50s. Apart from his table tennis uniforms, which match photos from the time of other athletes. So there's just so much realism, again, that you see in the movie. And I think that adds to the intensity of it and not taking you out as sometimes things that feel out of place do. Everything just looks and feels so seamless.
And our last nominee, we have Sinners. Our costume designer is Ruth E. Carter. She has two wins for Black Panther and Black Panther Wakanda Forever. This is her fifth nomination. And with this nomination, she becomes the most nominated Black woman in Oscar history. What did you think of the costumes in Sinners? And did you have a favorite?
I think a lot of what I just said about Marty applies here. I loved and what she talked about with playing with red, white, and blue in all these different ways, how smoke is identified by blue, stacked by red. And then we have Annie's, I would say, iconic blue dress, but then marries rose dresses with pink tones. It's very silky. And she was meant to look like a ghost. So I really liked how they made all the characters different and true to who these characters were or who they would become based on 1931 life and culture, and seeing these different factions all come together at the juke joint and how it's like this beautiful chaos of this amalgamation of people and costumes. What was your favorite costume from Sinners?
My favorite costume is from my favorite character in the movie, Annie, played by Wunmi Misaku. She has this blue dress, and in learning about Carter's inspiration here, I just found this so cool. I think because this was my favorite aspect of life in that time that they were dealing with here, which was like the hoodoo inspiration and who Annie was as a character. That was just my favorite part of the movie, unsurprisingly. But she wears a color that's called haint blue, and that is a specific shade of blue that was used in old Southern traditions that warded off spirits. So what we see her wearing in the film is a very specific shade of blue that would have protected her. And like everything from that dress to the beads that she's wearing, it's really meant to signify her role in that community. And when we first meet her, you have fringe. You see that she's carrying all of these things that really aid her in her magic. And I really love that detail. I think it really illuminates who this character is. And I also liked learning about Smoke and Stack and how the suits that they wear are so different from the other characters in the film. So, you know, they're coming from Chicago, so they're going to have really nice 1920s cut suits. But then our other characters, like Delta Slim, for instance, he's not going to have a new suit. So his costumes needed to be aged and worn in a different way to signify what his social standing was in the South at that time. So again, just a lot of different costumes on these characters, and they all feel, I think, really specific and connected to each person and what their role was at the time and what they would have been wearing. So what would your write-in vote be?
I would have included The Testament of Anne Lee. I think the dresses, the costumes, the layers that they have, not only do they look period correct from the 18th century, but I love that there's so much movement in the film and there are a lot of dances, the way the camera films the actors. But in that movement, the costumes just move along with them despite weighing so much. There are articles that talk about how much wool Amanda had to wear throughout the film, but I think because of that, it looks so light and effortless, their movements as they are dancing and singing constantly throughout the film. What would your write-in vote be?
My write-in vote would be for Lindsay Pugh for Hedda. I love the costumes in this film, and I think they're so fun, and they really, I think, show this like decadent, dark style of the film. And we also just have this really incredible look that Nina Hoss's character, Eileen, is wearing. And that costume, I think, becomes a central part of the story, especially when she comes in and the top part of that dress is soaking wet. It's just a very funny scene, and Nina Hoss really commits. But it recalls, I think, F. Scott Fitzgerald novels and these really, I think, just like rich party-focused texts, but also feels really specific to the period when the movie is set too, in the 1950s. So I would say Hedda here.
I was texting someone recently and I compared the costumes in Hedda to an original song being nominated when it's used in the film versus during the end credit scene. It's like the costumes in Hedda are characters. They're important to the plot, especially that one by Nina. So I love this inclusion. What do you think should win?
This was hard. I think there are some really great nominees here, but I'm going to go with Ruthie Carter for Sinners. I think that the work that she did here, it's so rooted in different pieces of history that all intersect really in this story. And in researching her process too, I was really struck with how she dyes her fabrics, how she ages pieces of clothing too. So they look like they've been worn. They don't look brand new or like they've just been dyed. And her whole entire team just works so closely together to really make these costumes feel like they belong to these original characters. So I would pick Sinners. What do you think should win?
I would go with Frankenstein. I love all the costumes. I think what Kate Hawley is doing, you know, she worked with Del Toro previously on Crimson Peak. So I think this is a world that she is able to live in and make look lived in very effortlessly. And I want more features like this. I want to see what else she can make because it's so decadent. The colors, the fabrics, textures, just I love how they flow in the wind and how big they are, yet how the characters fill them out or make them move very artistically. But I also like your pick with Ruthie Carter and Sinners. So our final category for today, we're going to talk about production design. Precursors here include the Art Directors Guild. Their ceremony is on February 28th. And the Set Decorators Society of America. Their ceremony is on February 21st. Our nominees, we have Frankenstein, Hamnet, Marty Supreme, One Battle After Another, and Sinners. What do you think of this group as a whole?
I think this is a great group. I was so excited to see One Battle After Another here. I think that was a really inspired, strong nomination, and kudos to you for predicting it. But I think there's so much happening here in a positive way, and there's so many amazing details that I learned in doing research for this section.
I agree. I love this grouping. You know, we have period worlds like Hamnet and Frankenstein that I would only say beforehand we could imagine being in, and then Marty Supreme, our native New York. So I think they all do an excellent job in transporting us to their different worlds, be it hundreds of years in the past or in present day. So for our first nominee for Frankenstein, our production designer is Tamara Deverell. This is her second nomination. And our set decorator is Shane Vaux. He has one win for The Shape of Water, and this is his fourth nomination. What about the set design or art direction did you like from Frankenstein?
Well, I think with Frankenstein, there's just so much here, really. So it's hard to pick one thing, really, that was my favorite. But I think the coolest thing to learn was that Tamara Deverell built that ship that we see in the beginning. And Tamara Deverell, we have to point out, has been on Oscar Wilde before. We interviewed her for her work on Nightmare Alley. So I learned that she went to art school in Vancouver, and one of her summer jobs was to work on ships. And she had always wanted to create one throughout her career. And she finally got to on this one. And to create this ship, she went to a few different maritime museums, and she talked with a lot of historians about what a ship in 1850 would have looked like. And she based the ship on the Franklin expedition to the Arctic. So looking at a couple of different ships that were on that expedition and then designing this one based on that. I thought that that was so cool that this was actually handmade specifically for this film. Because when you see it at first, it's huge. It's so grand. And she made that. So that would probably be my favorite set.
I also liked how for Victor's Villa, they used multiple houses throughout Scotland and outside London. So these are actual places. And then when they built miniatures and used miniatures to film some of the castle, which was actually an abandoned water tower, which I thought was really cool. Some of these miniatures, which when we talk about stop motion animation, they're small sets. And these miniatures, they called them maxitures because the water tower miniature was 26 feet tall. So I'm like, they're creating mini sets that are still humongous. So yeah, I think the work on the set, I love what you talked about with her building the ship, which was done on a Netflix lot in Toronto. So I think just very cool thinking about how these are done, either on sound stages or outside in the world.
I think so too. Next, we have Hamnet. So our production designer here is Fiona Crombie. This is her second nomination. And our set decorator is Alice Felton. This is also her second nomination. Both were actually nominated together for The Favorite. Did you have a favorite set from Hamnet? And what did you think of this production design?
Once again, being period correct was so important. I liked how they modeled the houses off of the real Tudor Jacobean home from Stratford. They didn't want to use the actual house because things had been modernized, but they built the ground floor of this house. They laid stone as the floor. It's just, I think the materials that they use make it look like a house that's been lived in for centuries. And then one of the most iconic shots from the movie is when Will is saying goodbye to Hamnet, and you see the town that they live in, and they brought in dirt, added this to the roads, and this is a real city that they made look like the 17th century. I think obviously the very end with the Globe Theater too, in a similar way that they didn't film in the actual Shakespeare home in Stratford, they recreated the Globe, but in a smaller size. They built this in 14 weeks, which is incredible. And I think the craftsmanship there with the tapestry of the woods that the actors really loved and just the authenticity of that really speaks to the film, the emotional impact of the ending. And I think, yeah, the work by Fiona and Alice. What was your favorite part of Hamnet?
I love the production design here. So first, I've been to Shakespeare's home in Stratford, and one of the things that is really surprising, I think, when you walk into a space from that time that Crombie and Felton do so well here is everything was made for much shorter people. Like, people didn't grow as tall back then, so doorways are much smaller, ceilings are a lot lower, and you really get that feel here from these spaces. They feel so authentic. And obviously, my favorite set has to be the Globe, but I think there is just so much detail too in the home. Like, even how the beds look, the dressers, the desks, everything feels like they're actually shooting on location with furniture from the 17th century. It's really, really great work. But with the Globe, when I was in London last, I went to the Globe and I had to have my little Hamnet moment there. I was like walking around listening to the score, and I just happened to do a tour. I hadn't done one ever before, and there was one more that day. And this woman asked our tour guide about Hamnet and if he knew if it was filmed there or not. And he didn't know, but I had to jump in like an annoying teacher's pet. And I told her, like, no, she actually, she built it. She made this. She didn't even film it here. Isn't that cool? And the woman was like, why are you talking to me? Please stop. But so yes, she recreated it. And what I really liked was that she wanted to think about how at the time there was this idea that the Globe had been built from stolen timber. And to do that, she actually brought in oak from France to build this structure, which was also based on round barns in upstate New York. And she wanted it to look like the inside of a tree. And when you think of how trees are so prominent in the film, I think that's such a beautiful little touch in addition to that mural of the trees that we see on the stage.
Our next nominee is Marty Supreme. Our production designer is Jack Fisk. This is his fourth nomination. And our set decorator is Adam Willis, and this is his second nomination. So what is your favorite set in Marty Supreme?
It's so hard to pick a favorite because this is Jack Fisk that we're talking about. He is my favorite production designer, and I think everything that he does is just stunning. It's not showy work. It is perfect, though. It makes the films that he works on feel like documentaries, I think. And when I first saw Marty Supreme, I thought, one, how did Josh Safdie get Jack Fisk? That's amazing. It's a miracle. And I think my favorite thing that he did was create that space that's a blend of a bowling alley and a ping pong parlor. He's really good at these multi-purpose spaces. If we think about his work in Killers of the Flower Moon, he also did that. You have the pool tables and the barbershop in the same place. But here, one of the things that I loved learning was that there weren't really ping pong parlors in many places. New York had some in the period, but Safdie and Fisk decided to combine them into one space because bowling was such a huge part of the period. So they had to scout for a bowling alley. They ended up finding one that would work. They found an old bowling alley in Hancock, New York, and then they extended the floor out so he could put in ping pong tables. And first, he was just going to do one, but they wanted many. So he ended up putting 6 ping pong tables in to that space. So it became this really large multi-use space. But one of the details I learned about it that I thought was so cool was that automatic setting of pins didn't start until 1954. But this film was in 1952. So Fisk, he realized that, you know, everything had to be handmade, but this pin setting wouldn't have been right for the period. So he had to figure out a way to not show that that setting was automatic. And they had to, you know, get creative with shooting the scene and building what that would have actually looked like at the time. So it's just that attention to detail that I think is so cool, of stripping away everything that would have come after 1952 and making it period correct.
Well, yeah, it's all of the details, especially around New York, making current New York look like, again, the 40s and 50s. There are stills from set, and you see Timmy standing in Midtown, and behind him is the Book of Mormon Theater. So the fact that they're using current New York and masking it, you know, adding in all of those beautiful old cars. What I found really interesting, especially in Tokyo, is that they're using period correct set pieces. So, I mean, that even goes down to the ping pong balls that they're using and the tables, because ping pong balls then were smaller than they are now. So even little details like that, and getting the correct size tables that you see in that really climactic match, I think that's fascinating, along with the interiors that we have, and I think that works so well with the costume design.
Next, we have One Battle After Another. Our production designer is Florencia Martin. This is her second nomination, and our set decorator is Anthony Carlino. This is also his second nomination. They were nominated together for their work on Babylon. What did you think of the production design here in One Battle After Another, and did you have a favorite set?
I love the production design here. I think from, you know, hearing from an early screening of them talking about being in real California locations, one that many people hadn't seen before, and really that adding to the realism of the film amplified what you were feeling. It was fun to learn that the La Purisima mission in Lompoc was the most fully restored and furnished of the 21 California missions. And, you know, you have those grand set pieces like that. Also just the hills in the very end and how they use 10 different locations and stitch them together for that sequence. That is absolutely not something you're thinking of in those moments. So I think that absolutely works. Again, it doesn't take away from the intensity of that chase sequence at all. And then I think just, you know, reading interviews with Florencia Martin, including yours, about tunnels and how they like constructed the one that he crawls through on a soundstage, but then tunnels like through the halls of the Christmas Adventures Club below the home, and just how I think the recurring image of that adds to the film of escaping, of the outhouse that he escapes to in the redwood tree from that tunnel under his home, and how like that really sparked this idea in DiCaprio to be like, oh my God, now I understand who this character is. Like, that's some of the details that help the actors themselves. So it's like, yes, it works for the movie, but it's like informing the actors of who they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, really cool. What about you? What are some of your favorite sets from One Battle After Another?
I love the work here. And yeah, in talking to her, what was really interesting to me was just how many details she pulled from conversations with the community, like in constructing Sensei's apartment and that labyrinth. She talked to so many people in El Paso and in their community about what those apartments would look like. And she even ended up getting some of her props directly from the people who lived in that community. Like, they lent her their cleaning supplies and things you would find in their apartments because they really wanted to be a part of this project. And I think that's such a great detail. One of the things that I thought was just fascinating that she talked about was this idea of the Christmas Adventurers hideout. She wanted it to feel like a fantasy a little bit of what would happen if there really was this underground network of tunnels that connected their houses and they were meeting early in the morning, what that would be like. And she looked a lot at Midwest American companies that would refurbish basements. And she looked at the lighting, how they would have this really strange molding and really artificial characteristics that would go into that. She wanted that to be a part of it. And they ended up creating that mural that was hand-painted in the background where you see it has this kind of Western feel to it. She included taxidermy and pheasants, and she wanted that to have a really specific look. There's a bar there. There's a coat rack. It looks like this place where these men would gather. And they also looked at train cars. It feels really similar to that, and just the dark wood. And one of the things I noticed right away when watching this was the great detail of spode, which is that specific Christmas china. Like, these men wouldn't be drinking from Santa mugs, right? They would have something that was a little bit fancy, that would be this kind of antique, subtle Christmas china. And she pointed out to me, which I've noticed on subsequent viewings now, that if you look at the archway, so when we have that shot where it shows the whole group saying, "All hail Saint Nick," if you look above them, St. Nicholas is carved into the archway.
Very cool.
Lots of fun details.
And our final nominee is Sinners. The production designer here is Hannah Beachler. She has one win for Black Panther, and this is her second nomination. And the set decorator, Monique Champagne, this is her first nomination. So did you have any favorite sets from Sinners?
Yeah, I think the juke joint is a really great creation, especially because we do spend a good amount of the movie there. But I really like where Annie lives. I think there is a lot of detail here. And I wanted to pick this also because I selected her costumes. And I think that production design and costume design go hand in hand so often. And one of the things I really was interested in was that Beachler was inspired by a Dorothea Lange photograph where she saw a woman standing outside of her home. And there was something about her home where it was leaning a little bit to one side. There was this massive field. There was all of this cotton that she felt really connected to Annie as a person who was serving her community, even though she was on a plantation. And one of the things that I also wanted to bring up about this is that her home also has that same blue that you find in her costumes to ward off spirits. And in the South, even still today on some old homes, they will paint the roof of their porch. So if you have like if you have a wraparound porch or a porch that's two stories, they'll often paint the ceiling that color blue, which is to symbolize the heavens and also to ward off spirits. So they were really looking at the traditions of the South and bringing that into not just her costume design, but also into the production design. So I thought that was really cool.
I loved reading about how it took 8 weeks for Hannah and the team to build the juke joint. At first, it could just seem like a warehouse, a barn that they refurbished or repurposed for this movie, but they actually built it up. And she was really guided by Ryan Coogler and the script, how he wanted to block certain scenes, what the images of certain moments would signify based on what characters were there in the moment. So I think there's so much more detail and work that goes into it that obviously seems seamless and flows with the camera, but is really a testament to the entire team as a crew of everybody working together to make it look that way. You don't really think of it like that in the film. And I think that's most impressive, especially when, you know, you see that barn with its walls taken off and you see everybody dancing during that musical sequence, and then how that space changes throughout the film, throughout the final act when the brawl happens and everyone's fighting. So I really liked that. And then I was just amazed by them bringing in 1,200 plants and then adding thousands of pieces of cotton to each of those. When you see them driving through the plantation earlier in the film, it seems like we were just placed there again, but it was deliberately made for this film. And I think that's just really, really impressive. So what would your write-in vote be for the category?
My write-in vote would be for sentimental value. So our production designer here is Jorgen Strangby-Larsen. And when I first saw this film, I knew I was going to love it instantly because of this old house and how the old house was personified by this essay that Nora wrote. And we get to see this house at so many stages in this family's history, and those were all recreated on sound stages. And Joachim Trier tells a story about how, because that was a real home, that people who had lived in this house were able to go back in and were able to visit and see those. And they told him that they forgot they were on a soundstage. They forgot that this was a set, because it actually felt like it did when they lived there. And I just love all of the details. I think that, you know, as someone who also grew up in an old home, it just felt so true to that experience. I used to listen to conversations through a vent that we had. I think that that is just something that you only really know, like a detail you only really know to include in the script and in the production design if you've had that experience living in an old house. So yeah, I think it's just, it's beautiful work that has mostly gone, I think, unsung all year. What would your write-in vote be?
I think in our theme of houses really defining our nominees, our choices, write-in votes here, I'm going to say Sound of Falling.
Oh, great.
I think that house that we focus on and the community around it for the majority of the film, we're inside that home that transforms throughout the generations, decades that we're watching. And I just love how the house is captured from top to bottom, the noises that we hear and how we interact with those characters in those spaces, either through keyholes or them sneaking around. I think you really have this idea that a home is a space inhabited by people and ghosts and the stories that are defined in those spaces. So again, another incredible film, not nominated, but so deserving and one that really sticks with you, I think, long after you've seen it.
I love that pick. And that's another one where we get to see the house through so many different generations and what it would have looked like. And that feeling of ghosts connecting. And what struck me about that film and Sentimental Value was just like what a house can hold on to, even though it's not right of a physical being or like a person or a sentient thing, you still get the impression that it holds all of those wounds and scars of time, which is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think should win?
I think that's similar to my pick in Hamnet because I love the natural world that we get. I really think the world that Chloe Zhao lives in herself and how that plays with the characters and how tied to the forest, trees, nature that Anya's is. And, you know, in that initial shot and those shots in the forest, we cut to this black void, this cave that she's by. And I think that image just really stays with you of where she came from or what that means for her, and that it's almost like this spirit and there's an entity to that forest. So I think coming from there, you know, where she was born and being in these houses, the globe, again, so specific of a finale and just an incredible place that you feel community and tied to everybody in that space during that first production of Hamlet is so special. And it's just a feeling that I love from her films. And I think, again, with this team that they just captured so perfectly. What do you think should win?
This is really difficult. I think there are so many options you could go with. I'm going to go with Marty Supreme. I have to give it to Jack Fisk whenever I can. He's never won, and that is just so crazy. And I really do think it's because his work just is not showy. It just feels so true to the period. And there are so many different sets you can go to and locations that he selected. You can look at how he recreated the shoe store, the pet store, those tenement apartments to all feel true to scale. The bowling alley, going to Tokyo, the Rockwell's Upper East Side apartment. I think it's all just really great work. My runner-up would actually be One Battle After Another because there are just so many iconic sets already from that movie. And she found those hills where they shoot the final sequence. And maybe she'll be my winner. Can I do a tie? Because there are just so many good details, too, that you don't even think about. Like the fact that Tim Smith, he has a vintage blue Mustang. And at the end, what's he driving? A rental car that's just a newer model of a blue Mustang. Like, that's just such a good detail that they had a lot of fun with. So, yeah, I want to cheat and pick a tie here between Marty Supreme and One Battle After Another.
Well, I kind of did at first also, so I think that's okay. I would probably also have One Battle as my number two. Like, yeah, there are some great choices here, but I think also just lots of great nominees that we talked about in general. So thank you all for listening to our first Contenders episode. Next time, we'll be talking about original score, original song, and sound with our frequent song lover and Oscar Wilde collaborator, Bennett Prosser. So come back to hear more about the Oscar nominees in those categories. But I love talking about everything today, lots of details, and you can expect all of this and more on our future episodes.
Yeah, I really enjoy doing this series every year. And it, like we said at the beginning, it just gives me a deeper appreciation for everyone nominated and all the work that goes into creating these films. So much more to come. Thank you all for listening. If you like our show, please follow us on Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, Blue Sky at Oscar Wilde Pod. And for bonus content, you can go to patreon.com/Oscar Wilde, where we'll be doing some bonus episodes this season on some nominee-adjacent films. And to check out updated winner predictions, you can go to our website, oscarwilde.squarespace.com.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.